nationalism and the transformation of working-class politics. And more recently, The Death of the Left, that explains how the left has shifted its focus from class politics to identity politics. Welcome to the show. David, what's this barrage of announcements about reform and the Zionist entity all about?
Well, what's going on here is that the Zionist entity are trying to work out how best they can pressure British politics. They, of course, have massive influence in the Labour Party and the Conservative Party. They don't think the Lib Dems will do anything, but they are influential there as well. And so they're just trying to work out whether reform is their next candidate to take over the government of this country. Now, that's a very worrying idea, but what it shows is that they are keen to play all sides. They're absolutely happy to buy off Keir Starmer and to support him with the resources. But if he does anything at all which they don't like, such as, for example, recognise the Palestinian state, well, then they will work with their other assets in the Conservative Party, in reform, and indeed the Islamophobic street movements on the streets like Tel Aviv, Tommy Robinson, then they will use them as well. And of course, they use them to play all sides against each other, and what they're trying to do here is trying to bring reform in to be the next government, and that's the truth of it.
Right, OK. Well, Steve, I mean, how did you come to find out about the infiltration of the far-right populists like the English Defence League?
Well, we conducted a research project about 10, 11 years ago. Members of the English Defence League, they were quite common up in the old industrial zones in the north of England and around Birmingham. And we were a team of ethnographers. We'd been working in criminology departments around the country, part of what we call the ultra-realist network. And what was quite remarkable was that they started to talk about Israel and their support for Israel in a way that was quite unprompted. We didn't ask them about it. They turned the conversation that way themselves. So we were talking about general politics. We were talking about their loss of faith in the Labour Party. Most of them were former Labour voters. And they were, you know, being out of work or living in some locales that were virtually derelict, couldn't find decent work. Some were involved in petty crime. And they expressed allegiance for Israel just out of the blue. And that was, we thought, quite remarkable because we hadn't prompted it. We hadn't begun, you know, to discussion. We hadn't started off a discussion about that, that's geopolitics in any ways at all. So that was the beginning of it, and that alerted us to the possibility that there were sort of Zionist influences operating at ground level. So it's not just from the top in you know, politics and Westminster and the rest of it. They were operating on the ground and influencing members of the British public.
Yes, indeed. It's not something you would expect somebody in the northeast of England, sort of just out of the blue, start talking about another entity elsewhere in the world. But David, just moving back to you then, I mean, you know, you've spoken, haven't you, about Zionist Islamophobia. I mean, just explain what you mean by that.
So, I mean, Islamophobia is the hatred of people because they're Muslim or appear to be Muslim. It's a form of racism. And of course, it's mushroomed since 9/11, with all the attacks that have been from the British state, the American state, and other countries against Muslim populations. But that, of course, is the perspective people generally have. But the underneath of all that, of course, is the fact that the Zionists have for many, many years, since the 1980s, in fact, been pushing the idea that the specific main threat against Western civilization is the Muslims. Used to be the Soviet Union, and now it's the Muslims. And they've been pushing that for a long, long time through various conferences. We've talked about this before, the Jonathan Institute conference in 1984 in Washington, D.C., run by Benjamin Netanyahu, the very same person who's currently the Prime Minister of the Zionist entity. So there's a specific Zionist component to the pushing of Islamophobia. And that's in part why most Western European countries have adopted counter-terrorism policies which are specifically anti-Muslim. It's not just because of their intelligence services and their foreign policy interests, but because there's been a push specifically from the Zionists.
Right, OK. Well, Steve, Nigel Farage has a long history, doesn't he, of Islamophobic remarks?
Well, he does, yes. I mean, you know, I remember videos and photographs of Nigel Farage, you know, walking along the street with members of the National Front in the 1970s. One would love to be a fly on the wall, or perhaps not love to be unpleasant experience. But as a researcher looking for data, it would have been good to be a fly on the wall to you know, just to hear what was going on, what was being spoken of. But what we saw, I think, from the 1970s was a slow shift, as David Miller has just said, from anti-communism, anti-socialism amongst the hard right, towards Islamophobia. And indeed, when we conducted the research amongst the English Defence League 10, 11 years ago, we found that Islamophobia was the focus of their ire and the focus of their hatred. So they were pro-Zionist, pro-Israel, even though upon, questioning, we did take that a little further, they didn't know anything about Israel. They didn't know anything about the history of Palestine, the history of the Israeli occupation or anything. They were just pro-Israel because that they thought that was the thing to be. And they were Islamophobic because they thought that Islam was their enemy, that Muslim immigrants were culturally distant and alienated from them, and their culture was a threat, and that their economic position was a threat. Yeah. You know, the usual tropes about taking all the jobs and all of this.
Well, David, you were sort of touching on this just a moment ago, but the prominent Zionists, have been throwing a lot of money at reform, haven't they? I mean, from what you were just saying earlier on, and it seems to me that, is this just another attempt for the Zionist lobby to buy yet another political party?
Well, of course it is, yes, and that's what we showed in the film there, some of the key people who've given money. These are not the only people who've given money, but there's a Zionist component to the funding of reform, and we can show that with the data which has been disclosed to the Electoral Commission. And some of these people are, of course, in all sorts of odd financial industry places, and one or two of them are based in Monaco and not actually in the country, and so all this stuff about Britain first and Britain for the British, at the same time as the people who are funding this party, actually not even based in the country. So the traditional nonsense you get from that. But this is a specific Zionist push to put money into the party. But at the same time as the Zionist entity itself, you saw the deputy ambassador there, the president, the foreign minister just the other day, actually making overtures towards reform, and they're pushing them to take centre stage in British politics.
Steve, I saw that Gideon Sahar, the Zionist entity's current Minister of Foreign Affairs, posted on X the other day about his phone conversation with Nigel Farage. I mean, are they just withdrawing support for the Labour government, do you think, or are they just sort of playing both horses?
Well, I think I tend to take David Miller's position that it's an all-round attempt to court political parties, because we're in a volatile situation at the moment economically. We're seeing the rise of BRICS. We're seeing the possible decline of the West. We're seeing the dollar tanking. We're seeing all sorts of volatile events taking place at the moment. And politics are on the back of that, of course, are equally volatile. So we don't really know what's going on. We've seen the Labour Party tank in the polls. We've seen reform rise. We're seeing the Greens rising at the moment. The Greens are presenting more feasible economic policies. Mm-hmm. So I think that the Zionists have a tough job at the moment. They have to guess who's going to be the next government, they're going to guess who's going up and down in the polls, and they're just trying an all-round blanket approach, which must be quite difficult. But of course, they're experts at this. If you read Ilhan Papp, for instance, Zionist lobbying on both sides of the Atlantic, they've been doing this for a very, very long time. And the only real people that are resisting are amongst the left, and some of the old traditional one-nation conservatives, people like Peter O'Byrne and others who are against this sort of thing.
Our next report explains why right-wing TV news outlets like GB News are constantly running cover for Israel's atrocities.
The reform leader, Nigel Farage, is a presenter on GB News. The Parliamentary Register of Interests shows he made nearly £400,000 from GB News since August 2024, more than £2,000 an hour. But who owns GB News? Legatum, a private investment fund based in Dubai in the United Arab Emirates. The UAE normalized ties with Israel through the Abraham Accords in 2020. The agreement covers cooperation in diplomacy, trade, tourism, and investment. The UAE exhibits chronic Zionism and total subservience to Israel. Legatum also funded a think tank in London, now called the Prosperity Institute. In 2021, academic Matt Goodwin was appointed director of the Center for UK Prosperity, and he remains a senior advisor. Goodwin also presents a show on GB News. Here he is claiming to be Britain first. Watch his reaction to being asked about supporting Israel.
I don't want that. I want a national unifying politics which puts Britain first, not Pakistan, not Gaza, not any other foreign policy thing. Britain first.
Not Israel? Not Israel?
Israel is a very close ally. Well, until recently, it was a very close ally of the United Kingdom. We should look after our allies. Unfortunately,
no, we shouldn't.
Unfortunately,
we should look after. We should look after Britain.
Unfortunately, Israel no longer feels that we are a reliable ally, thanks to the Labour government.
When GB News was set up in 2020, genocidal Zionist Jonathan Sacerdoti was employed for 4 months as a pre-launch development consultant. Sacerdoti was previously with the Campaign Against Anti-Semitism and is now a settler colonist in Tel Aviv. He recently traveled to the UK, where he could be found shilling for Tel Aviv Tommy Robinson in London on YouTube. From the beginning, GB News has been a Zionist asset.
Well, blimey, David, I mean, GB News is ploughing loads of money, isn't it? Loads of money into the Nigel Farage and other right-wing figures, isn't it?
Well, that's right. I mean, the figures are there in the package, but I mean, it's worth repeating them, isn't it? £400,000 in the last year, 1 year,
yeah,
for presenting a show on GB News. I mean, that's just truly extraordinary. And of course, Farage pays it to his company, charges VAT, doesn't have to pay personal tax, and it pays corporation tax, and thus, of course, he exploits the Exchequer a little bit more. His company's, of course, offshore. He says it's not illegal, but it's certainly immoral. And of course, doesn't fit with the alleged policies of the party. And then Matt Goodwin, I mean, he's a kind of academic who's become this kind of poster boy for the far right. I guess he's moved more further right than he used to be. He used to work in a department where I used to work in before I got there, in Bath, and he's really very, very far to the right now, very in with the kind of racial and ethnic prejudice boys, and works for Legatum. So he's both working for Legatum and being paid for that, and working for GB News and being paid for that by Legatum.
Yeah.
So that, I mean, we don't of course have any register of interest for him, but it would be very interesting to see how much money he's getting
absolutely
paid.
It certainly would. Well, Steve. Reform voters are less likely than any other party to approve of a Palestinian state, aren't they?
That's right. And we did our research. Of course, the Reform voters and a lot of these voters have been formerly connected to these street protest groups, the EDL, etc. A lot of crossover from movements like Britain First, but also to speaking of Goodwin, they're attracting a lot of former Labour voters. We have this strange diversion of former Labour and left wing voters over into the far right. So the Reform voters are coming in from various positions. And it seems that the Zionist influence has a sort of pan influential position where they've been, influencing various political positions across the spectrum. So this is quite dangerous. I think that Reform voters aren't coming specifically from a lineage from the 70s of the old far right. They're being drawn in from a lot of positions now, which our research has tended to show. So I think we're in a very difficult position.
Yeah, we certainly seem to be. But David, I mean, we mentioned this firm, Legatum. I mean, just tell me a bit more about them, will you?
So it's a firm, right? It's an investment firm. It's based, as we said, in the United Arab Emirates. There's one guy who was in charge of it, and he's now brought on three other guys. So there's four of them at the top of it. And they do little videos saying how lovely it is and how they get on fantastically with each other while they're ripping off people all over the world. So they make huge sums of money. They're in a part of the UAE which, where there's no tax, where they can repatriate all the profits to wherever they want to, and no doubt some of them go offshore as well. So that's the company. Now, the company set up this think tank called the Legatum Institute in the UK some time ago. It's now called the Prosperity Institute. And they also, of course, have a foundation where they give money to all sorts of right-wing causes, and they have GB News. So it's an operation which spans quite a range of activities. It's making money, it's spending money on propaganda, and it's spending money on think tanks and research and the kind of lobbying that goes with that. So that it's a kind of interesting organisation from that point of view. And, of course, it's based in the United Arab Emirates, which is the closest state in the West Asia to the Zionists. Does what the Zionists want. It leads on taking other West Asian states towards the normalisation, such as, for example, the Saudis and Bahrain as well, and other countries too. So it's a key location, not just for the tax reasons, but also for the normalisation with Israel.
I mean, it sounds quite benign in some ways, doesn't it? You know, promoting prosperity, but who's the prosperity for?
Well, it's for those people, isn't it? It's for people who are making the profits offshore, not paying any tax, and of course they're operating, the think tank operates in this country, but the people who supply them with the money don't pay any tax in this country, they pay all.
But these people claim that they're championing the working classes of Britain.
Well, of course they do, that they're very, very far from that.
Yeah, no, it certainly seems to be that way. But Steve, I mean, that clip though with Matt Goodwin, I mean, it says a lot, doesn't it, about the so-called Britain First movement, doesn't it?
Well, it certainly does, and it says a lot about the other movements on the right. And I think what we have to look at here is that, you know, organic reproduction, sorry to use that technical term, but I'll explain what I mean. What we're talking about so far is the sort of manufacture of consent model, propaganda coming from top and through institutions, mass media, education and all the rest. And that's difficult enough to deal with. But the problem is that it becomes organic once this word spreads along the ground. This is what we found, that being as Islamophobic and pro-Zionist was becoming an unthinking norm. And just by word of mouth spreading around the place. You shouldn't be anti-Zionist, you should be pro-Zionist. You shouldn't like Muslims, you shouldn't like Islam, you should hate Iran. They're authoritarian and all the rest of it, the same as China and Russia, of course. And when it becomes organic, then it becomes even more difficult to deal with. And we've got to get in on the grassroots, on the ground, and start to change perceptions. Yeah. So we have a very, very, I mean, you know, people like Goodwin, mouthpieces like Goodwin are to a penny. But it's when it starts to reproduce itself organically that we really have something desperately difficult to deal with. And it's about time that we started to address that issue.
Yeah, indeed. Got a classic case of manufacturing consent, it seems, Steve. But just tell a bit more, will you, about this Jonathan, this character Jonathan Sakodaty for us, will you?
So this is the guy who first came to public attention 10 years ago, where he'd been the I think one of the vice presidents of the Zionist Federation of the UK, and I think around 2015 or so, he was started to appear on the TV news as coming from this think tank, the Institute for Middle Eastern Democracy or something like that. You can look at it up on his LinkedIn page. And he would appear on TV on the BBC as an expert. And one of the things we did at the time was we said, actually, this guy's from the Zionist Federation. He's from the...
No, indeed.
And they actually had to stop doing that. So he went from there to work for the Campaign Against Anti-Semitism. He was their press officer for a while, which, of course, was engaged in fabricating anti-Semitism scare stories, and still, of course, is engaged in the very same today, taking you to court next month.
Yeah.
So there was that. And then, of course, he moved on to do the stuff with GB News, and then he went off to become a settler columnist, and he has a role on GB News, and he appears on Fox and all the right-wing news things. So he's a voice for hire. And he now, of course, is shilling for Tel Aviv, for Tommy Robinson.
Sure. Well, Steve, finally, and briefly, because we have not got much time, what's your overall view about the possibility of any section of the British right breaking from Zionism now? I mean, we know about Nick Griffin, the former British National Party leader, who's very critical of Zionism, but he seems to be a bit of an outlier, doesn't he?
Well, he does, yes, and there, you know, have been outliers throughout the history, both the left and the right. We had, you know, in the Labour Party, people like Christopher Mayhew in the 60s, and people like, more recently, Alan Duncan in the Conservative Party, people like Peter Oburn, but they're all outliers. And this is why I stress my point again, it's becoming organic. It's not about manufacturing consent as much as how the consent is starting to manufacture itself, and that puts us in a very, very difficult situation.
But I'm afraid that's all we've got time for today. But we'll be back next week. I'd like to thank our guest, Professor Steve Hall, and of course our resident expert, Professor David Miller. So until next time, when I hope you'll join us again on Palestine Declassified, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Madarisi with you with another edition of Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll discuss some of the contents of chapter Naml, the 27th chapter of the Holy Quran, as well as some of the commentary points of the verses. Brothers and sisters, as you were with us, we are discussing the 62nd verse of this chapter. Now let's listen to this verse.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
أَمَّنْ يُجِيبُ الْمُضْطَرَّ إِذَا دَعَاهُ وَيَكْشِفُ السُّوءَ وَيَجْعَلُكُمْ خُلَفَاءَ الْأَرْضِ أَإِلَهٌ مَعَ اللَّهِ قَلِيلًا مَا تَذَكَّرُونَ
Is he not best who responds to the desperate one when he calls upon him? and removes evil and makes you inheritors of the earth? Is there a deity with Allah? Little do you remember.
So, brothers and sisters, in the previous episodes, we entered the long discussion of dua, supplication, and the relationship between supplication and its acceptance. Because the verse we are discussing says, أَمَّنْ يُجِيبُ الْمُضْطَرَّ إِذَا دَعَاهُ وَيَكْشِفُ السُّوءُ, or the one who answers the call of the distressed and actually removes the distress from him. So, regarding this, we said that there is this concept of dua, which is from the supplicant, أَمَّنْ يُجِيبُ الْمُضْطَرَّ إِذَا دَعَاهُ, when he calls on him. And there is this concept of ijaba, أَمَّنْ يُجِيبُ, the one who answers, the one who accepts. Now, we said that we cannot fully discuss the concept of relation between the two without taking into our consideration the aspect of obstacles. We said that there are some obstacles that we are not aware of, they are not mentioned explicitly in the specific verses that discuss concept of supplication and dua in the Holy Quran, but we see it scattered throughout the different traditions. Our traditions and narrations, in them we see plethora of examples of different conditions, requisites, prerequisites for the acceptance of dua. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, for example, is narrated to have said that at some times a servant makes a petition and Allah, the Blessed, the Exalted, says, grant his need quickly because I hate his voice. But some other times, it is narrated to have said, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, that a servant makes supplication and Allah, the Almighty, the Majestic, says, I have indeed answered him, but I need him confined to his need because I love listening to his voice. So, even if the acceptance of prayer is detrimental for the supplicant, Allah the Exalted does not absolutely annul the response to the prayer. This is the most important thing. He, subhanahu wa ta'ala, out of his mercy, transforms this supplication to be a kind of kafara of his sins, and makes actually this a means of forgiveness, or the Almighty Allah converts it to a provision for him in this world, and grants him instead lofty stations in the heaven. So, this is the most important thing. There are sometimes some obstacles that we might not consider in the very first place, but they are actually affecting the acceptance of dua.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma صلي على محمد وآل محمد.
So, brothers and sisters, regarding this verse of the Holy Quran, this verse, أَمَّنْ يُجِيبُ الْمُضْطَرَّ إِذَا دَعَاهُ وَيَكْشِفُ السُّوءُ, in this chapter, we said that there are sometimes there are some delays, some substitutions in the acceptance of a prayer, that the servant might actually mistakenly see them as the signs of rejection. But the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wasallam is reported to have said, no Muslim calls on Allah the Glorious provided that his prayer has not been made for severing the ties of kinship or committing a sin, except that Allah shall grant him one of the three things. Either he subhanahu wa ta'ala will quickly grant his prayer, or he will delay it, or he will avert calamity from him of its like. Why? Because we read that it is said, O Messenger of Allah, we will increase in praying in this case, said his companions. He sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wasallam replied, indeed, do increase. So, this is what the companions of the Prophet were told by him he sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam is also reported to have said that prayer and dua is the essence of worship. And dear listeners, this is what we have thoroughly discussed in the previous episodes. There is no believer who prays to Allah, but that he subhanahu wa ta'ala responds to him. Either he quickly grants it to him in this world, or delays it to the hereafter, or forgives from him some of his sins to the extent that he has prayed to him. So long as he does not pray for a sin. And we also see that through the tradition of the Ahlul Bayt, how through their conduct and their lifestyle, their lifestyle is replete with these kinds of things. In his will to son Al-Hasan, according to the narration of Sharif, Imam Ali alayhi salam says, "Thus, delay in his response should not disappoint you, because that which is granted is according to the intention of the supplicant." Some of the time, Imam Ali says to his son, some of the time, response might be delayed so that it may greatly increase in the reward of the supplicant and cause ample bounties for the hopeful in Allah. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.ir. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me, worry, and that's when faith begins.
You kill in the name of freedom. You kill in the name of democracy.
Is it not enough what you've done with all the bloodshed you've caused? Yet your greed drives you on. In your brutal race for acquisition, no land is left untouched. Driven by a vile ambition to have the whole world in your clutch. Every single new addition to your slave colony does nothing to dull your ambition to leave no nation free. It is indeed a sad condition that you suffer from, this itching desire for prime position, to have all under your feet. Not in my name will you fight. Not in my name will you kill. Not in my name will you burn a child. Not in my name will you love. Not in my name will you invade. Not in my name will you break. Never. against your evil methods of violence and intimidation, against your hijacking and misinterpretation of my peaceful faith and revelation. I shout with billions in this demonstration. Not in my name will you fight. Not in my name will you kill. Not in my name will you burn a child. Not in my name will you love. Not in my name will you invade. Not in my name will you pray. Not in my name will you dare to speak again. Not in our name. Not in our name.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me, proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away, proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
It's a pleasure to have you back, Sheikh Javid. We have been discussing some of the jurisprudential laws of miscellaneous nature based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. And let me ask you this question, what is the rule concerning women's participation in social activities involving religious and cultural matters? So what does Ayatollah Khamenei say about that?
Well, women's participation in social, cultural, and religious activities is permissible in and of itself. Of course, there are certain conditions to be taken into consideration.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, the activities conducted by ladies in a social atmosphere must comply with the principles of Sharia, such as observing hijab,
yes,
avoiding unlawful mixing,
mm-hmm,
and maintaining dignity. These are very important for ladies. Ladies coming out of their homes and in engaging in social activities must not mix with men, and if there are men in their environment, they should the ladies must observe full hijab in their presence. There's another condition also. There is no legitimate concern that participation will lead to sinful consequences. Okay, such as, for example, immorality or corruption or something like that. So their participation must not lead or involve any kind of fitna or any kind of mischief, and you can call it sinful consequences, because if there is such likelihood or chance of getting involved in a sinful act, then it's not permissible. According to the rules of marital rights, a married woman must also seek her husband's permission before leaving the home, unless leaving the home is for necessary duties that do not require his consent. These are also very important condition. Mm-hmm. A woman engaging in a social activity must obtain her husband's permission and
mm-hmm
consent. Otherwise, it's a kind of disobedience or recalcitrance
mm-hmm
to leave the house without obtaining his permission.
Even if it's for godly purposes?
Of course, you want to pray and your husband does, for example, someone, a lady wants to pray in a mosque and, you know, the husband does not consent and he wants to, and his wife to be available at home. So she goes out into mosque to perform her prayers, or maybe she embarks on a journey to Mashhad, to Iraq, to yes. visit the holy shrines
yes.
without the consent and permission of her husband.
Mm.
This is not permissible. This is one of the rights of the husband to be observed and to be fulfilled by the wife.
I see.
There are reciprocal duties and obligations for both wives and husband, and both the parties to the marriage must be very mindful of their duties.
I see. Thank you very much. Stick around while we come back after a short break momentarily. Stay with us.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/em. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah, don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javed, our guest speaker. We are talking about some of the jurisprudential laws of miscellaneous nature based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khomeini. Sheikh Javed, we know that any stains of blood, basically, we are required to remove if it happens to be like on, for example, the exterior part of our body.
Right.
What if this bleeding happens internally? Imagine this scenario that somebody goes to the dentist.
Yes.
All right. And they pull out one of their teeth, basically, right?
Yes.
So sometimes it happens as a result of pulling the teeth, the blood appears in the mouth.
Right.
All right.
Oh, yes.
So are we required to purify this blood, this interior part of the mouth, too?
Right. That's a good question. Well, no special purification is required in that case. According to Islamic Sharia, the interior of the body is not treated the same way as the exterior.
Yes.
Yes. There are two different things. If blood or impurity, ayn al-nijasa, appears inside the mouth, its removal or natural dissipation in saliva is sufficient for purification. Like, for example, there used to be blood in your saliva, and now when you look at your saliva, you see that there is no blood, there are no traces of blood, and the blood has completely disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it's not necessary to wash your mouth and make it clean. Yeah, there's no blood and the saliva is clean. Mm-hmm. Okay, if the blood was on this outer, the exterior of your body, then that's another issue. You should have to wash that part of your body. So I would say that if blood or impurity appears inside the mouth, removal is not necessary. And when it disappears, it's okay. The mouth is automatically purified, and there's no need to rinse the mouth with water before praying or any other religious duties which require some kind of purification.
I see. But you know that this happened to me, that I smelled some kind of like something like iron.
Right.
Like a metal type of smell
yes.
in the mouth when such things happen.
Yes.
And you feel funny about it. So even if when you look at your saliva, when you spit it out, you see that there is nothing in it, but you still smell that kind of metal, stuff or scent back in it, right? So are we required to remove it?
I think you are too much obsessed with purity and impurity, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You want to make sure that there's no blood. I think
yes, in the mouth.
This is not acceptable.
I see.
The religious authority says that you have to be easy with it. You don't have to worry about about
but
it
when it
all.
Comes to najasa, we all know that in the Rasala has been prescribed that you need to take care of several conditions. One of them is the scent, the smell of the najasa, right?
There's nothing. That is, well, first of all, the interior of your body, that's in your mouth. There's no trace of blood in your mouth. And that more than an addition, you are being more, very much particular about it. You want to be very matic, exactly.
Fussy.
obsessed with it. And of course, Islam is quite against the OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder.
Yes.
And the scholars advise every individual, man or woman, not to be very much obsessed with impurity. Consider everything pure unless there is any sign suggesting that it's impure.
Mm, thank you very much, Sheikh Javid, for that tip. Let's take a short break and then we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio. Stay tuned.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma صلي على محمد وآل محمد.
Welcome back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws of miscellaneous nature according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. I asked you a question regarding bleeding, Sheikh, before the break. Is the blood that appears under the fingernail or toenail due to some impact, canonically impure?
Right. The ruling depends on how the blood appears, right?
Yes.
If the blood beneath the nail is so absorbed or altered that people do not commonly recognize it as blood, it is considered pure. You know, there is a black sign under the nail, and it doesn't mean that it can be removed. It is, the blood is there, and the blood is all over, maybe inside the veins running, moving. It doesn't mean you have to get rid of it. So, of course, in that case, you don't have to do anything. But if it is still clearly recognized as blood, then it is impure. And in this case, of course, if water can reach it without undue hardship, the blood must be drained and the area must be purified before wudu or ghusl. But sometimes it's kind of difficult to remove because it's trapped under the nail and there's nothing you can do.
Yes.
This is blood, but of course you are not supposed to get
do anything.
Otherwise, you will lead. You will have to go through unbearable hardship,
or medical operation, very slight one, but again, you have to go under the knife.
I said that if draining the blood might cause excessive difficulty or harm, hardship, then one should wash the area around the nail carefully without spreading the impurity. And then His Eminence says that he should cover it with a cloth or plaster and wipe over it if it is, there is a kind of maybe blood over it which cannot be removed, it might be difficult to remove. And so, but if it's under the nail, there's no need for it. It's trapped inside under the nail. And so, that's it.
Yes. Another quick question, just to wrap up our session. Are the important leather or leather products canonically impure or pure if we are uncertain as to whether they are derived from a properly slaughtered carcass?
Right. Of course, if it is certain or reasonably possible that the imported leather comes from an animal slaughtered according to Islamic law, then the leather is pure. If there is a strong chance or a greater possibility that the leather might have been, the leather might be from an animal slaughtered according to Islamic law, then the leather should be, or the product made of leather, should be treated as pure. But if such possibility does not exist, for example, if it certainly comes from a non-halal source, of course the leather is considered impure and cannot be used in acts of worship that require purity, such as salat, such as the tawaf of hajj, and its prayers, and all these acts of worship which require the ritual purity.
And the leather should come from the skin of the halal animals.
Of course, the halal animal. But if even that halal animal is not slaughtered according to Islamic law, then it becomes a dead body.
Uh-huh.
A dead body slaughtered, which has not been slaughtered. A dead body is as impure as any other animal that is not halal to eat.
Thank you, Sheikh. That was Sheikh Javed talking with me, answering my Islamic laws related questions according to fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. That's it from me, Muhammad Javed, the host of this program. And the rest of the crew, we bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Good morning to all listeners from around the world. You're tuned in to Iran Radio, coming to you from Tehran, and I'm Asma, your host for the next hour. We start this hour's lineup with a radio productions feature. In this program, we broadcast excerpts from the speeches of well-known and reputable Islamic scholars. After that, we have Around the World with reporters. Reporters from around the world tell us what is happening in their corner of the world. Listen to fascinating reports from countries both near and far. Our varied radio productions feature will be next. And our final program this hour is A to Z of Life. The program presents an Islamic Iranian lifestyle in a variety of ways, making use of the ayahs of the Holy Quran as well as inspirational poetry and stories. Stay with us for the next hour.
More than one-third of Iranian pilots of the Phantom fighter jets were martyred, captured, or went missing during the eight-year war between Iran and Iraq, marking the highest casualty rate among all branches of the armed forces. This program is dedicated to those unforgettable heroes, to the men of the most challenging cross-border operations the Phantom Fighter Pilots of the Air Force. The Phantom fighter jet was originally designed to defend U.S. aircraft carriers against enemy aircraft. However, its exceptional capabilities led the U.S. Air Force to adopt it as well. With the ability to carry over 8 tons of weaponry and its long operational range, the Phantom was employed both as a light bomber and an air defense interceptor. In Iran, Phantoms were purchased to fulfill both roles, serving as light bombers and interceptor fighters. As he was returning to base, the radar informed him that an Iraqi MiG-21 was bombing Iranian forces in the Sadpol-e-Zahab region.
من منصرف شدن از برگشتن رفتن پایگاه به رادار گفتم من میرم دنبالش.
Atiqichi changed course toward the target. The Iraqi pilot, upon seeing the Iranian fighter pursuing him, quickly fled into Iraqi territory. In November 1981, a week after the martyrdom of Ikradi, Major Atiqichi and Captain Ali Ashkan were flying over the region of Ilam. Ground radar informed them an Iraqi aircraft was approaching. The opponent was a MiG-23 known as the Flogger. At that time, the MiG-23 was considered Iraq's most advanced fighter jet. The Soviet Union had developed it to counter the new generation of American fighter jets. Qarabaghi's sudden decision to use the afterburners reduced the explosive impact of the Iraqi missile by dispersing the engine's exhaust gases and flames. With great difficulty, he managed to land the damaged Phantom on the runway. An hour later, Colonel Golchin, the base commander, confirmed the downing of the MiG-21 had been hit by Qarabaghi's aircraft machine gun. The Iraqi aircraft, damaged by gunfire, had failed to return to its base. During the middle years of the war, the Air Force suffered heavily from sanctions. While the war was taking its toll on Iranian pilots and aircraft, the country was unable to purchase any new planes. Aircraft parts were rarely available and had to be acquired at extremely high prices from the black market. Meanwhile, Iraq was receiving advanced fighter models in large numbers. New variants of the MiG-23, equipped with upgraded heat-seeking missiles for aerial combat, were entering service. But the Phantoms faced even more serious opponents, MiG-25s and French Mirage F-1s. The Mirage F-1 is a fast and agile aircraft with delta-shaped wings. Its design and electronic systems